Round two. Fight!
Ladies and gentlemen, let's get ready to rumble!
Welcome to the Under Duress edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Scott Horsley, sitting in for Ken Rudin.
Ken Rudin is on the road. And Scott, you're joining us from...
The White House.
The White House.
From a closet in the basement of the White House, but still, close enough.
Very well. Highly secure, I'm sure.
Just two stairways and some very beefy-looking security guards from the Oval Office.
Beefy security guards. Well, beefy security guards make me think immediately of the vice presidential debate, which was this week. And it's the only vice presidential debate. So it kind of reminds me of those one-game playoff deals where you get into the playoffs.
One and done.
One and done. So your assessment, Scott Horsley.
Well, you know, Joe Biden's main charge going into the debate was to avoid having the word lackluster assigned to his performance.
Or listless.
Lackluster was a term that got a lot of use because people wrote about President Obama's performance in the first debate. And there was no luster lacking in the vice presidential debate. That debate ran over with luster. I think Biden succeeded in ginning up the base of the Democratic Party, folks who maybe were a little despondent, got re-energized. The question is whether his somewhat over-the-top performance might have won over independents or turned them off. And I guess we'll have to wait a little while to see how that plays out.
Certainly it was prominently featured in the critique of Biden's performance that we got from the right and from the Republican campaign. And we heard a lot even during the debate about how smirking was unappealing and how it was turning people off and so on.
And I have to say, you know, I've talked to a lot of debate experts and certainly people who studied the history of debates do talk a lot about the nonverbal cues, Al Gore's sighs or, of course, George H.W. Bush checking his watch. And those are important signals that the candidates send to
George W. Bush checking the box on his back.
But when I was looking at some of the commentary, it was just overwhelmingly about the nonverbal cues. And I think we ought to still give some attention to the verbal cues and what these guys actually say during the debate. Don't be so overwhelmed with the eye rolling or the smiling or the smirking that we forget to pay attention to what the candidates are actually saying.
You know, Scott, I was afraid that if we had you on the podcast, you'd bring substance in. And I'm going to give you a chance to do that in just a moment. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about the other guy who was in the debate, Paul Ryan. What did he need to do in this debate?
Well, of course, Paul Ryan is still introducing himself to a lot of the American public, people who don't follow the budget trials here in Washington, to whom he's not well known. And I guess the threshold question he had to answer is this someone you could imagine stepping into the presidency if that need arose? And in particular on foreign policy, I thought he cleared that threshold. That was perhaps the area with the biggest question mark. How was he going to do? People knew he could handle fiscal questions, but how would he do talking about Afghanistan or Libya? And I think he at least cleared the bar on those topics.
Turns out he knows the names of lots of towns in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Some people felt like that seemed a little too rehearsed and maybe a little bit too much like the kid acing the geography quiz, but I thought it came across as knowledgeable. He talked about visiting Afghanistan way back in 2002 when he was, I think, 18 or something like that. So.
And he was loaded for bear, certainly, on the question of whether or not the Obama administration was on top of things in Libya, where their initial explanation for what happened in Benghazi and the death of four Americans there, including our ambassador to Libya, was that there was some kind of huge protest over the video, of course, that we've talked about before. And now it turns out there was no such protest. It was pretty much just a straight-ahead terrorist attack. Joe Biden tried to answer that characterization of the situation, tried to turn the attack back on Mitt Romney for politicizing what he called a tragedy. But Paul Ryan was ready and pounced.
This Benghazi issue would be a tragedy in and of itself. But unfortunately, it's indicative of a broader problem. And that is what we are watching on our TV screens is the unraveling of the Obama foreign policy, which is making the world more chaotic and us less safe.
All right. This was the first occasion then in the debate when Joe Biden saw fit to use a word we don't often hear in presidential debates, malarkey.
Our adversaries are much more willing to test us. They're more brazen in their attacks. And our allies are less willing to
With all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey.
And why is that so?
Because not a single thing he said is accurate.
Oh, and by the way there, we just heard the voice of Martha Raddatz. Martha is from ABC News, and there had been just a little bit of controversy about whether or not she should be moderating because at her first wedding, her first marriage, one of the attendees was a student named Barack Obama. But at any rate, the connection to Martha Raddatz and the Obama-Biden campaign does not seem to have bothered anybody too much, except for a few people in blogosphere on the right. And certainly anybody watching the debate last night would have had to have been impressed with what an extraordinarily expert and even-handed job she did.
Oh, I think she's gotten widespread praise from all sides of the political spectrum after the debate. And might want to mention that before she went to ABC, of course, she was with us here at National Public Radio.
Indeed.
Speaking of malarkey, there was also an exchange about the stimulus. And Paul Ryan talked about $90 billion of green pork in the stimulus, sort of repeating a claim that at the top of the ticket Mitt Romney had made in the first debate, suggesting that it was all just a bunch of Solyndra. And that brought this retort from the vice president.
And I love my friend here. I'm not allowed to show letters, but go on our website. He sent me two letters saying, by the way, can you send me some stimulus money for companies here in the state of Wisconsin? We sent millions of dollars. You know why he said
he did ask for stimulus money.
Sure, he
correct?
Did. By the way,
on two occasions, we advocated for constituents who are applying for grants. That's what we do. We do that for all constituents who are.
I love that. I love that. This is such a bad program. And he writes me a letter saying, writes the Department of Energy a letter saying, the reason we need this stimulus, it will create growth and jobs. His words.
His words and every mainstream economist who's not in the tank for the GOP will acknowledge that the stimulus bill did, in fact, save or create millions of jobs, helping to head off a worse recession. I thought one of the stronger points for the vice president, and it's a point that the Democrats don't make very often, is that while we have seen a lot of slowdown in growth in the last couple of years, arguably that could be attributed to Republican intransigence in passing some of the additional jobs bills that the administration put forward. And Joe Biden made a forceful case last night that if the GOP would get out of the way, there might be more opportunities for growth.
That was one of several moments at which Joe Biden said almost exactly the thing that many Democrats had been waiting for Barack Obama to say in the October 3rd debate, and which the president almost in every case failed to say, or at least failed to say in such a fashion that people remembered it or noticed it as he was saying it.
Yeah, the thing was, Joe Biden was just much sharper about pushing back against misstatements and evolutions and twists and turns of the person sitting across the table than the president was in his first debate with Mitt Romney. And of course, now we're all waiting to see if the president drinks a little bit of Joe Biden's coffee before Tuesday night.
Well, we know that coffee is going to get brewed up by a lot of Democratic candidates for other offices who have been watching what has happened to the president's polls and to their own, in many cases, polls, because the president's position has weakened since that October 3rd debate. We have seen the national polls come close to either even or a slight lead for Mitt Romney, which would be the first we have seen from Mitt Romney since before the conventions. And we have seen the polls also close up in some, if not all, of the swing states. You hear people now starting to say, Florida looks like it's going to go for Romney. So you see it pink, if not quite red, on a lot of the website maps. And you hear people saying, well, Virginia's looking a little tougher for Obama because of the debate, and so on, throughout the list. So the Electoral College math, while it's still kind of daunting for Mitt Romney, he needs to get more than two-thirds of the toss-up state's electoral votes if he's going to win, at least now you can see a possibility of him actually doing that.
It's certainly true that all the swing states look a lot closer than they did before the debate. But if you just freeze the map as it is right now, the president still has the better path to 270 electoral votes.
And much of that is based on Ohio. That's why the president Mitt Romney have been practically camped out in Ohio. If you give Florida to Romney, then it's really necessary for the president not to lose Ohio. But if Mitt Romney can't wrest Ohio from him, it's very difficult to see the path by which he wins.
That's right. If the president can win Ohio and almost any other of the real swing states,
Virginia, not
New Hampshire. Oh, he doesn't even need the biggies. If he can win
Colorado.
If he can win, let's say, Ohio and Nevada. That gets him where he needs to be. Ohio plus New Hampshire leaves him a couple of electoral votes shy. But almost any combination with Ohio is a winner for the president.
Now, this could have something to do with the other thing that's been going on in the Romney-Ryan campaign this week besides the vice presidential debate, and that is a Romney reset, as it's been called, a move to the center on taxes, on immigration, on health care. We even saw this on abortion, where in Des Moines this week, Mitt Romney went to the Des Moines Register editorial board, seemed to be really moderating his abortion position quite a bit and suggesting he wasn't going to do anything on that issue, so his own campaign had to come out and make a statement about how pro-life he was and how he was going to be the candidate who would support the values of life.
And this has been a real surprise for the Obama campaign because everybody expected to see this sort of moderation as soon as Mitt Romney had locked up the GOP nomination.
Etch-a-sketch.
And we didn't. If anything, he moved further to the right. I mean, tapping Paul Ryan as your running mate is not exactly a shift to the center. And this is one thing that the Obama campaign has begun to push back hard against at campaign rallies, but there's still a lot of teeth gnashing that the president didn't push back harder during that first debate.
And it
was interesting, too, in the vice presidential debate, you didn't see Paul Ryan backing away quite as much. Paul Ryan is still a little bit more willing to stick to his guns on something like voucherizing Medicare, although he doesn't like that term.
He doesn't like the word voucher.
He doesn't like the term.
But he calls it premium support.
But he doesn't mischaracterize what the plan would do.
Am I interrupting you or are you interrupting me?
I had 5 seconds left before
that
you
I still. I believe this was Martha, can you tell this man that this is my turn to talk?
Go right ahead.
Really, I'm missing Ken Rudin here because usually at about this point in the debate, he starts complaining about how little he's gotten to speak. But this week, he's really not getting much chance at all. There are a number of ways we can accomplish the principles that let's let Mitt Romney say this. This is how he explains his tax plan without the specifics on what he would change.
There are a number of ways we can accomplish the principles which I have, lowering rates for middle-income people, making sure high-income people don't pay a smaller share, and simplifying the code, and then encouraging growth. So as to how we approach the various deduction limits, and what I do know is we're going to have to reduce the deductions pretty substantially for people at the high end, because I don't want to make the code less progressive.
There are a number of ways you could do that, but you can't do it and cut rates by 20%. It just, the math doesn't work.
Okay, but now you seem to be putting a thumb on the scale here, Scott. I mean, are we saying that this is just a misrepresentation of reality on the part of this campaign?
Well, it's not necessarily a misrepresentation of reality. If they're saying, look, we floated this plan, and now tax professionals have taken a look at it and said it doesn't pencil out, so we're going to tweak the plan so that it doesn't either explode the deficit or shift the burden to the middle class. That's certainly possible. That's not, however, what the Romney campaign has said. What they've said is, we can do it. It is mathematically possible, and unless they've got their own math, I don't see how you make that happen.
Now, I can remember some times in the past when there have been some arguments about math and about the math or the good math, but it seems at this juncture in the campaign, both with the move to the center on certain issues and with this rather blithe attitude towards the details of a rather central part of the plan, that the Romney campaign feels it can cruise, that they can essentially do what they need to do, whether it's moving to the middle or whether it's essentially asking for people to just wait and see the plan later, because they're doing better, that their conservative base is not going to object to the moderation of some of the positions, and that they're not going to get too much pushback from the rest of the world because they're doing better. They had a great debate. They're moving up in the polls. Mitt Romney is suddenly hot.
And moderation sells to a significant chunk of the electorate. There's a significant chunk that says, look, we don't want extreme positions. We want something that works. And that's the tack that the Romney camp seems to be taking. So this is the question. Is this merely an election tactic by the Romney campaign to get through the election and then to shift back to the severely conservative stance that Mitt Romney took during the early part of the campaign?
His word, severely conservative. Or
is this who Mitt Romney really is? And, of course, that's that's the question that folks have been asking ever since his days as governor of Massachusetts.
So trying to raise that question is one big Obama tactic. Another is, well, trying to explain his own weak debate. We've all dumped on it a lot, so let's give the president a chance here to defend himself.
Yeah, the president was asked about that lackluster debate performance in an interview this past week with ABC World News.
You know, maybe this is because I played a lot of sports when I was a kid and still do. if you have a bad game, you just move on. You look forward to the next one. And it makes you that much more determined. The difference between this and sports is that the stakes are so high.
You know, by all accounts, the president is somebody who, when he suffers a setback, doesn't spend a whole lot of time dwelling on it, but does look ahead. But he is somebody who plays a lot of sports, who knows a little bit about sports strategy. I was thinking about a basketball-themed fundraiser that he attended back in August that was hosted by Michael Jordan. And he talked about the fierce competitiveness of the Chicago Bulls. And he said, you know, if you got a small lead late in the fourth quarter, that's not the time to let your opponent get back in the game. And, of course, that's exactly what President Obama has done in this campaign.
So we might say that the president has been fortunate that by letting his opponent back in the game, things have not gone any worse for him in terms of the polls or in terms of the energy dynamic of the campaign than they have. And part of the reason that they have not gone any worse is because the president has also gotten, coincidentally, a little run of good news. The campaign, the Obama campaign, raised $181 million in September, far more than the Romney campaign did, and by far and away the best month any campaign has ever had. But even more important than that, they've gotten good news on the economic front.
That's right. The unemployment rate fell last month below 8% for the first time since the month that President Obama took office. We also got initial unemployment claims this week showing the lowest level of new people filing for unemployment in 4 years. Now, we do have to say both of those statistical snapshots surprised a lot of forecasters. Both seemed as if they were perhaps subject to some statistical noise. These are both based on, reports in the case of initial unemployment claims.
Surveys.
And surveys in the case of the unemployment rate. And they can be volatile. They can be noisy. There can be quirks, which is a very different thing than what some on the right and former GE executive Jack Welch suggested, which is that they're subject to outright political manipulation.
That the Chicago gang got to these guys.
Yeah, it's one thing for honest people to look at these numbers and say, wow, that's a mighty big shift that nobody was looking for. Maybe there's a little something weird going on in the statistical model. Maybe the seasonal adjustments are a little out of whack. Maybe there's some reporting problems going on. All kinds of things can affect the numbers with nothing nefarious or overtly political about it.
Well, apparently those political manipulators or that gang from Chicago in their long, sleek car have driven all the way up to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and influenced the report of the University of Michigan on consumer confidence this week as well. This number, which has been languishing in the 70s for a long, long time, and by the way, that's the territory where presidents don't get reelected when consumer confidence is down that far in the 70s. The average for presidents who do get reelected is up in the 90s, nearer 100. This particular number went from 78 in September up to 83 in October. That's a sizable increase in 1 month. Still quite low for a re-election fall, but a lot better than being in the 70s. Coincidence?
And it reflects both the way people feel about the current state of the economy and their expectations that it's going to get better.
That's right. And this is not a government number. This is a number that's arrived at by academics. It is a question, is there an anomalous month out there? Is September just a month that's coming in a lot of measurements as unusually good, more of a robust recovery month than what we've been seeing over the summer and late spring? And is that just good luck for the president, or is there something going on?
President Obama does have a history of getting lucky when it matters.
Well, you could call it lucky if you want to, Scott, but of course, there is also the question of allies. The president has allies in very powerful places, and I think you saw that in the cable-only ad that they were running this week.
Bernie Madoff, Ken Lay, Dennis Kozlowski, criminals, gluttons of greed, and the evil genius who towered over them. One man has the guts to speak his name.
Big Bird. Big Bird. Big Bird.
It's me, Big Bird.
Big, yellow, a menace to our economy. Mitt Romney knows it's not Wall Street you have to worry about. It's Sesame Street.
And this week's podcast was brought to you by the letters N, P, and R.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving here at NPR headquarters.
And I'm Scott Horsley at the White House. God willing, Ken will be back next week.
God willing. Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Sesame Street out. You gotta do it.